Hi, welcome back. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia. It is great to have your company today. And in the second hour of today's show, I'm going to be getting back into the topic that has been one of the most dominant and one of the most important ones that Truth News has covered since we've been doing this program for the last 4 years. And of course, it is the topic of climate change. And I just want to run through some of the key points here that I believe are essential to understand for those who support our government's position on climate change. You're actually buying into a number of arguments, and I want to just quickly outline what they are before I introduce our very important guest for today's show. Firstly, if you are supporting our government's position on climate change and the carbon tax, you are agreeing or believing that observed global warming is significant above the background variability. Two, you are agreeing and believing that observed global warming is caused by an increased level of carbon dioxide, which is above the background variability of CO2. You are also agreeing that increased carbon dioxide is caused by human activity. You are agreeing that global warming, if real, is necessarily a bad thing. You are also agreeing that putting a price on carbon dioxide emissions is necessary to solve the problem, if indeed it is a problem. And finally, the icing on the cake is that you are agreeing or believing that there is a consensus among scientists and relevant experts that points 1 to 5, which I just mentioned, are all proven to be true. Now, on that note, I would like to introduce Professor Bob Carter, an expert in many fields of science, a geologist and a lecturer at the University of Townsville, one of our most important climate skeptics in Australia. Professor Carter, are you there?
Yes, good morning, Harrowood. Nice to be with you.
Look, it is great to have your company, Professor Carter. Now, I gave a little introduction there about some of those points. Do you think I hit the nail on the head in terms of what I said in my introduction?
Well, you hit several nails on the head, very squarely, yes. And I'm sure many of your listeners will, in a sense, have already been familiar with that, but perhaps subliminally. And it's very helpful to have you list out the key issues.
Absolutely. Now, you, of course, have been working to provide a point of view to basically balance out the debate on this topic for many years. Unfortunately, your voice has rarely been heard in the media. And of course, last week we had a television program on ABC, the Q&A show, which did a special on the climate change debate. And the whole reason for the show last week was to actually engage with the debate, because the ABC has acknowledged, and this is actually on the page there that they've got for this documentary called I Can Change Your Mind About Climate Change, they acknowledge that about 70% of Australians don't believe it. They're dismissive. They don't agree with it. The purpose of the show was then to engage with the debate. Unfortunately, the only person with a scientific background who they had on the panel was Megan Clark from the CSIRO. There was a politician, an ex-politician, Nick Minchin, and essentially a businessman, Clive Palmer. I just would like to know, were you invited, or was Professor Ian Plimer, another important Australian skeptic, invited to participate in the ABC Q&A show last week?
Well, I can only answer on my own behalf, and the answer is no. But I would have to say, on previous track record, it's extremely unlikely that Ian Plimer or any other independent scientist was invited either. Again, your summary is accurate, but let me return to one point in it.
Sure.
The panel itself, to discuss a scientific question, had no active scientists. Now, that's really quite remarkable. People will say, but the CEO of CSIRO was there, and she's trained as a scientist. Well, that's true. Megan Clark was trained as a scientist some 30, 40 years ago, but she's now an effective full-time manager. So there's no active scientist on a panel to discuss a scientific topic. I would like to say this is, well, this is certainly amazing, and I'd like to be able to say it's unusual, but of course it's not in the least unusual. The ABC and SBS and other television and radio stations have form, I'm afraid, on this issue. And they tend to only reproduce the views or allow the public to hear the views of the side of the argument that they agree with. And, of course, that side is the argument that our industrial carbon dioxide emissions are causing dangerous global warming. Now, that has become such an embedded political and societal belief that we're in a rather dangerous situation where even our public broadcasters are quite unable to address both sides of the question in a balanced way. And so this is almost a parody, this program the ABC put on, if the intention was to look at a scientific issue in a balanced way, because they had no scientists there, basically, to advise them on the issue.
Yes, yeah, so it really is quite incredible when, you know, the purported goal is to engage with a debate, and then there is really no opportunity for the one side of the debate to have a voice. And of course,
well, let me cut over you there, Herod, sure. Because actually they did engage with the debate, because the debate is not scientific, and that's the
right
problem. So the debate, as it is occurring over the last 10 years and as seen by the ABC, is a political, sociological, environmental debate. It is not scientific. And of course, they did address that question of, do you believe, is a phrase they often use, in climate change? Well, what a stupid question. Firstly, scientists are paid to not have beliefs. That's why you pay a scientist, to present you with the evidence and a dispassionate discussion. So the very language that is used, do you believe in climate change? And then the next thing is, as you addressed in your introduction, do you believe in climate change? Well, of course you do. Climate change is naturally. So when they ask you, do you believe in climate change, that is political, sociological code for, do you believe in dangerous global warming caused by human carbon dioxide emissions? That's the key question, but that's not the way they put it, because if they put it that way, most people will look at the evidence and say, well, there's no evidence for it. But if it's turned instead into a sociological issue, do you believe in climate change and you're a heretic if you don't, is the implication, then they can confine the argument along the channels that they're comfortable with.
Right, and in terms of there being a debate or an argument, you might say, they're quite happy to frame it in terms of Anna Rose versus Nick Minchin. Neither of them really experts in science. Therefore, it becomes a sort of a more personal journey of those two people, and then we are sort of drawn into that. And in a way, we're distracted away from the key scientific questions, although they do use the scientific so-called proof continually as the backdrop of that little journey that Nick and Anna had together in the documentary. So they do continually refer to, and obviously the authorities, the government, the IPCC, continually refers to a supposed body of fact, which is supposedly backed up by science, to actually prove their case. But look, why don't we just start with some of those points? Let's just run through those points that I gave in my introduction, and let's actually get your take on those points that are the basis of the so-called scientific facts of climate change. So, observed global warming is significant above the background variability of warming. I mean, over to you, Professor Carter.
Well, global warming is just one aspect of climate change, and climate change can take place in two directions. It can get warmer or it can get cooler. And the first thing to understand is that the climate never stays unchanging for any significant period of time. It's always either warming or it's cooling. And those changes between warming phases and cooling phases take place on timescales between 2, 3, 4 years, as we go from an El Nino to a La Nina weather cycle, for example, the La Nina one will globally The El Nino one will globally be rather warmer than the La Nina one. So on that time scale, 3 to 4 years, there are warming, cooling cycles. Now you can go to the sunspot cycle on an 11-year period, and again, there are climatic cycles. You can go to 18 years, which is a tidal cycle. You can go to 70 or 80 years, which is another solar cycle, and so on, out to 20, 40, and 100,000-year cycles, which relate to the changes in the orbit of the Earth around the Sun, and that controls the major glacial-interglacial cycles that we see. So the point is that climate is changeable on every timescale. And to come to the issue, which I stated earlier, it's not, is climate change happening? The issue is dangerous global warming being caused by human carbon dioxide emissions? Now, that's a testable proposition.
Right.
The mixing time of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is about a year. So if we put a molecule of carbon dioxide out of the exhaust of your car, it could be in Antarctica or in Greenland atmosphere over those places in about a year. That's the circulation time of the global atmosphere. Okay, so if we take a 10-year period, we can presume the carbon dioxide is mixed, and it's a long enough period to take. And if we take the last 10 years, then we find that carbon dioxide level of the atmosphere has increased by a little bit more than 5%. And over those same 10 years, the global average temperature has basically flatlined or cooled a little. So those facts are a test of the question you asked, which is dangerous global warming being caused by carbon dioxide emissions? And the answer is no. And that's what scientists do. They set up ideas, they call them hypotheses, in order to test them. And you test a hypothesis against the facts. Now, the problem with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that you referred to, the United Nations body that advises governments on this issue, is that they don't test that idea against facts. They test it against computer models. And basically, those computer models, they're very clever. The people that do them are extremely well-trained, qualified, intelligent people. They do them to the best of their ability. But basically, they are playing Sony Xbox computer games. And they're asking the question, what if we presume this, this, and this about the conditions on the planet, and then we increase the carbon dioxide, what possible outcomes will there be in 100 years' time? And those outcomes in 100 years' time can be changed, not just from the rate of warming to being greater or lesser, but even to cooling in the future, depending upon how you tweak various things inside the model. Because there is no theory of climate change, as there is a theory of gravitation. You can't just put
Professor Carter, we're just going to add break.
The other end comes the global temperature.
We're just going to add break now. We'll be right back after these short messages. Thanks. With Truth News Radio Australia.
Disinformation, misinformation, deception, deceit, spin, untruths, half-truths, lies, you know the truth. Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au.
Oh, where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I've crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. And it's hard, it's hard, it's hard, it's hard, it's hard. Rain's gonna fall.
Hi, welcome back. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia. And today we are talking about climate change with Professor Bob Carter, one of Australia's most important climate skeptics. And we're running through some of the real scientific questions and getting his take on that. And Professor Carter, just before we move on, I just want to, I mean, you gave a great summary there of all of the uncertainties about temperature and CO2. But the one point I just want to get from you is that the IPCC and the government is telling us that there has been a dangerous warming that is over and above what we've seen in the past that has occurred in the last, say, 50 years. And what have you got to say about that?
Well, I'll pick up from where I was going with that. Before I do, let me just react briefly to your use of the word skeptic. Now, I realize you're just using it because it's the parlance, but the reality is it's got no meaning as addressed to any scientist, because any scientist is a skeptic. That's what scientists are. They're trained to be skeptics. So it's just as true that the scientists who are advising the IPCC are skeptics as it is I'm a skeptic in general, as just a general scientific technique.
Sure.
But at the point where you're testing a hypothesis, such as dangerous global warming caused by human carbon dioxide emissions, the appropriate approach to take is agnostic. In other words, you have no interest in the outcome. Let the facts fall where they may, and then we will conclude whether that hypothesis is true or not. So most of the people who are called skeptics, including me, the more appropriate title would be they are climate agnostics. They don't have a dog in the fight.
Mm.
They don't care about that. All they care about is give me a scientific theory and I will use scientific methodology to test it. So independent scientists or agnostics is a better label. But now getting back to your question,
sure, thanks.
We were just concluding that the test of the dangerous hypothesis is the last 10 years of climate record, and we've had no increase in temperature accompanied by a 5% increase in carbon dioxide. And that just immediately falsifies the dangerous global warming hypothesis. But you might say, well, but hang on, that's only 10 years. What about a longer timescale, Bob? We're talking about climate change here.
Sure.
Well, to some degree we are. But when we test the hypothesis, we're not talking about climate change. We're talking about a physical mechanism of greenhouse gas radiation in the atmosphere. And you can test that, as I said, over 10 years, short period of time, because it's much longer than the mixing time of the atmosphere.
Right.
But if you actually want to test, is warming happening, which was your question, over a longer period of time, the answer is, as I said earlier, well, it depends what period of time. How long is your piece of string?
Yeah.
Now, it's certainly true that there was a phase of warming between about 1979 until 1998, roughly the turn of the century. So for about 20 years in the late 20th century, the temperature warmed gently. It didn't warm at any greater rate than it's warmed many times in previous geological history. And then since about 1998 or 2000 or so, the temperature's flatlined and declined gently. But if we go back 150 years to when we have the first temperature records from thermometers, then it's certainly true to say there's been a warming roughly half a degree, perhaps, so far as we can tell, in the last 150 years, and probably another half a degree in the 100 years before that, because the world has recovered from what's called the Little Ice Age. In medieval times, particularly in Europe, there are many, many records, not thermometer records, of course, but written and archaeological and geological records, that the climate was very cold. So on the timescale of the last 200 or 300 years, we are on a warming phase at the moment. Now, it turns out that one of the cycles of climate that I spoke of earlier is about 1,000 years long. It's probably a solar-controlled cycle. And the Little Ice Age was the peak of the cold part, or the trough of the cold part of that cycle. Prior to that, it was very warm around 900 to 1000 AD, in other words, about 1,000 years ago. So warm that it's called the medieval warm period. It's actually got a name. So we had the medieval warm period about 1,000 years ago. We had the Little Ice Age about 500 years ago. And now about 400 years on, we're in the warming part of the cycle coming out of the Little Ice Age. And the late 20th century warming interval is just part of that longer warming recovery from the Little Ice Age. The point is that there are, as I said, cycles upon cycles upon cycles. So I've just talked about a 1,000-year-long cycle, But piggybacking on the back of that, if you like, high frequency changes on the back of that are things like the El Nino La Nina cycle and other shorter term weather and climate cycles. So
absolutely,
it's complex, but it depends over what period of time you want to look. A geologist will say, well, we're lucky we live in a warm interglacial period. We give it a name. We call it the Holocene. And it's lasted for 10,000 years. If we go back twice that period of time, 20,000 years ago, we were in the peak of the last ice age. There were big ice caps over New York, over Stockholm, and the water that fed the precipitation came down as snow to build those ice caps was evaporated out of the ocean. So obviously what happened was the sea level went down. Most people are astonished to find how far it went down. Sea level went down about 120 metres. This is 20,000 years ago when we had the big ice caps. That meant that Australian native inhabitants, the Aboriginals, could walk from Victoria across Bass Strait, because it was dry land where Bass Strait is today, to Tasmania. And similarly, you could walk across Torres Strait from Papua New Guinea to Australia. So these are dramatic changes driven on the longer time scale. But the geologist looking at the social problem, because it was a good question to ask, we are producing greenhouse gases. We are producing carbon dioxide. It is a greenhouse gas. It will theoretically cause some amount of warming. Is that warming dangerous? That was a very good question to ask back in the 1980s when this first came to the fore. And if you then look at that in a geological context, you say, well, we're living in a warm interglacial period, so let's look at the Holocene, the last 10,000 years. How does today's temperature compare with the average and the long-run temperature over that 10,000 years? And the answer is we are on a cooling trend. And at the start of the Holocene, there's a period of time between 10 and 8,000 years ago, roughly, when the temperature was 1 to 1.5 degrees warmer than today. Let me say that again, because you're right. Every newspaper, every politician, every lobby group on the planet is telling the public that the temperature today is unusually warm. That statement is utterly, completely false. Just 10,000 years ago, the planet was about a degree and a half warmer than today, and it's on average cooled about a degree and a half in the last 10,000 years. And the little bit of warming in the late 20th century, notice it's the late 20th century warming. It's not the 20th, 21st century warming, because that phase of warming finished in 1998 or 2000, there or thereabouts. So the point is that it's horses for courses. How long is the piece of climate string you want to look at to answer the question, is warming happening? And if you look at what most people would say is the proper geological context of the last 10,000 years, then we are today significantly cooler than the average temperature over that period of time. So what is the problem?
But of course, unfortunately, what you're saying comes against a backdrop in a lot of people's minds of that famous graph that the IPCC presented, I think, was it in 1995, which had the shape of a hockey stick, which really looks very alarming because it appears to show a fairly stable temperature range that suddenly peaks up at the end of the 20th century. Now, you're, of course, saying that that particular graph is false.
Do you remember in the First World War in Britain, they had to get some more people to fight the war, and there's a very famous poster of Lord Kitchener with his hat on and his finger pointing straight out at you saying, your country needs you. Do you remember that poster?
Yes, yes.
Well, that's used to be the most famous propaganda poster of the 20th century.
Right.
Now, the hockey stick you refer to actually first appeared in a scientific paper in 1998, and it then became the focus of the argument in the IPCC's third assessment report, which was published in 2001.
Right.
But the diagrams first published in the late 20th century. Those of my academic colleagues who teach in graphic design and communications departments in tertiary institutions, I believe are already using the hockey stick you referred to is now the greatest propaganda diagram of the 20th century. It even exceeds Lord Kitchener's advertisement. And the reason is it is based on very careful statistical analysis of records that are unrepresentative, and it completely ignores and goes against a huge variety of other evidence that I've just talked about in part, coming from geological studies, that the temperature goes up, temperature goes down by a degree or so over periods of decades to hundreds to thousands of years. And there is no evidence from hard geological studies of the past for this hockey stick at all. It's basically a contrived statistical study.
Professor Carter, we're just going to break again. Thanks for that. That's brilliant analysis there. We will be right back after these messages.
The man who stole the water will swim forevermore, but he'll never reach the land on that golden shore. That faint white light will haunt his heart till his only memory lost in the dark. Dig a hole in the ground, straight down to hell, till there ain't no more water in the well, well, well. When you're down on your knees with nothing left to sell, won't you try digging a little deeper in the well, well, well? Say well.
Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Today my guest is Professor Bob Carter, geologist and a scientist who provides another point of view on the climate debate, but from the point of view of someone who's really done a lot of research, has a lot of knowledge. And we've been going through, well, for the last half hour or so, we've really just been looking at this question about temperature. You know, is temperature increasing? Is it increasing in a way which we haven't seen before? Is it somehow different to the pattern that we've seen in recent or in longer geological timeframes? And certainly the answer appears to be no. It is just very much within the patterns that we've seen in the past. I was wondering, Professor Carter, could we actually have a look now at the question of CO2 levels? Because this is another one, and if you remember from the Q&A program last week, they presented this other alarming graph from the Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii, where they showed CO2 levels apparently skyrocketing. And in the interview, the scientist, I just don't have his name, I think it's Jonathan Barnes, he said that in response to Anna Rose's question about whether this was higher than what we've seen in the past, he said it's certainly higher than what we've seen in the last million years. And he's also said that we're certain this is caused by human emissions. Is there anything you can add to that?
Well, I'm fascinated. The careful control of language by these people, and by these people, what I mean is that that scientist making that statement is very similar to other scientists that work for the IPCC around the world. They choose their words very carefully. Now, in fact, it's probably not true that the carbon dioxide level today is higher than it's been in the last million years. And I will tease that out, but before I do, let me say it is also completely misleading to suggest there's anything special about the last million years, and that in comparison with earlier geological history, we live today, even after all our industrial emissions, we live today in a time of planetary carbon dioxide starvation. In other words, it's exactly the opposite of the situation the public's told about. Let me explain. On the shorter timescale, we have accurate measurements from 1958 in the atmosphere of the increase in carbon dioxide. And before the Industrial Revolution, about 150 years ago, the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was about 280, and the units are parts per million in the atmosphere. So it's a trace gas, tiny amounts. Okay, now we're producing carbon dioxide industrially, we are, and that is accumulating in the atmosphere to some degree, and it is, so the level's going up. And the measurements in Hawaii, the laboratory that Anna Rose and Nick Minchin visited, that laboratory produces the best measurements in the world, and they show that since the 280 parts per million before the Industrial Revolution, we now have arrived at 390 parts per million. So that's a more than 30% increase. And you might say, gee whiz, that's a big increase. Well, it is in comparative terms, but it's, of course, still only a tiny trace gas. And the question you need to ask to assess whether that's dangerous is exactly the same as the question you asked about temperature, which is it true that this is a high level compared with previous geological history? And the answer is no. There are two ways we can look. Firstly, and what the Hawaiian scientists had in mind is data from ice cores. And ice cores are a quite unique planetary archive because in the ice there are little bubbles of the atmosphere at the time the ice layer was laid down, snow. And it's really a most remarkable thing. So you can take an ice core and go down a kilometer beneath the surface, and you've got in your hand a block, or in the laboratory now, a piece of ice that's, let's say, 50,000 years old, and you can melt it in a retort. And those little bubbles, of course, will then come into the retort, and you've got in your lab a sample of the atmosphere 50,000 years ago. Now, that's just magical science.
Yeah,
very
great.
Clever stuff. And when you analyze the carbon dioxide in the ice core samples, you find that as you go from a warm period, an interglacial, as we live in today, to a glaciation, as we had 20,000 years ago, you find that roughly the carbon dioxide level changes from 280 parts per million in a warm period, and that's what it was before the Industrial Revolution, remember, to 180 parts per million in a cold or glacial period. And that pattern, 280, 180, 280, 180, is relatively consistent back for half a million or three quarters of a million years. And the oldest ice that we will find in Antarctica is about a million years old. And that is where that number came from that scientists spoke of. So in that sense, it's true that the natural, in inverted commas, level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere in the warm periods over the last million years might be said to be 280 parts per million. However, the samples that are taken from the ice cores are averaged because the ice gets squeezed at great depth. And to get a big enough sample, the sample you take, it represents 100 or 500 or even 1,000 years of time. And so if the average we measure in such a sample is, in a warm period, let's say 280 parts per million, then it's obvious that the numbers going into that average will have some that will be less than that and some that will be higher than that.
Yeah.
So it's highly likely that were we able to have the resolution in the ice core measurements, that we would actually find numbers at least as high as we have today. But that's a detail compared with the killer. The killer is this, that as we go back in geological time, we find that when multicellular animals, little worms, little crabs, little mollusks, first started wandering around the bottoms of the ocean, that was 500 million years ago during a period of time called the Cambrian. And at that period of time, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was 15 times today's level, was 4,000 to 5,000 parts per million. And yet the ocean was not boiling away, the atmosphere was not particularly hot. Everything that we find from the fossils and the environments, when we look at rocks of Cambrian age, it looks much like today. Of course, it's not exactly like today, but the general environmental background, the temperature and so on, looks to be about the same as today. So, we
and of course, correct me if I'm wrong, Professor, but also during that the Carboniferous period, where the CO2s were levels were much higher, we had a massive forests that well, covered most of the planet. Is that correct?
I'm just getting to that next.
Sure.
So here we've got at the start of the evolution of multicellular life, we've got 15 times today's level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Where did it come from? And the answer is before that evolution of life, multicellular life, 500 million years ago, we've got another 4,000 million years of planetary history before that, during which there was much volcanic activity and the carbon dioxide comes out of the volcanoes and accumulates in the atmosphere. So the interesting question is, we know why there was 15 times today's level of carbon dioxide in the Cambrian. It's because it had been produced by outgassing cumulatively by volcanoes. The really interesting question is, why is there only 280 parts per million before the Industrial Revolution today. What on earth happened? And you put your finger on the point. What happened is land plants evolved. And that happened in a period a little bit younger called the Devonian, about 400 million years ago. And then during the Permian and Carboniferous, which are the periods that follow the Devonian, there was a huge explosion of evolution of land plants and the formation of great forests, which led to great coal deposits that we still mine today. And, of course, those plants are carbon dioxide factories. They depend. It's food, plant food. So they sucked, cumulatively, a lot of that carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And where did they put it? They put it underground in the coal beds. So now we come along and we mine the coal and we get all the economic advantages of cheap energy and employment for people mining, all the rest of it. And now what do we do with carbon dioxide? Well, of course, we put it back in the atmosphere where it came from in the first place. What is the problem here?
That's a really interesting way of putting it, and really it makes a lot of sense. Sorry, are you there?
Yes, I'm there.
Yeah, sorry, sorry.
You expect me to respond.
I was just in a little thought bubble there, just sort of reflecting on that. Because the way you describe it really, indeed, there doesn't appear to be anything we should be concerned about. It's just the way the information is presented to us to make it look so alarming. And I really think, you know, obviously there is another agenda at work. Obviously there is a political agenda. Obviously there are people who are trying to bring in changes to the way our system works, the way our economy works, the way our society is structured, who are trying to run a case that there is a big problem here. But I mean, I made the point in my last show that when we saw this information, for example, about the carbon dioxide levels, that the scientists at Mauna Loa have only been monitoring since 1960. So they're using one particular method there for the last 50 years. But of course, that method is not the same as pulling a bubble of gas out of an ice core. And they're running the argument that they sort of have all this data and that they've got it effectively, you know, proven that there is a definite change. Whereas, in fact, it must be a lot more uncertain than that, mustn't it?
Well, no, there is uncertainty, but there is a change, and we talked about it. There's a 30% increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
Of course, yes.
In the last 150 years. So carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, is it? Yes, it is. So if we put more in, and what does that mean? It means that outgoing heat from the Earth, which radiates up through the atmosphere, instead of escaping straight to space, if it bumps into a molecule of greenhouse gas...
Professor, we've just got to go to break. Sorry to cut you off. We're just going to ad break right now.
Sick of the lies, deception, spin and half-truths? Well, so are we. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia. Tune in every week at truthnews.com.au or subscribe to the podcast with iTunes or your favourite podcatcher.
Welcome back to Truth News. I'm today talking to Professor Bob Carter, and we are towards the end of the hour, and we've only just kind of got ahead of steam up here to start talking about some of these questions. I do hope we can get you back on again, Professor Carter.
I'd be delighted to do that, Harry Wood. Now, can you remind me what the question was just before we took the break?
Yes, well, we were going through the history of CO2 levels, and you made that stunning point about how, in fact, during the Carboniferous periods, all of that coal was put into the ground. We've dug the coal up, we've burned it, and of course we've released that CO2 back into the atmosphere. And what's the problem? And I was actually at a loss for words when you said that, because
it's one of those points. Perspective, and that's a perspective that people need to think about. But the good point, which you then asked the follow-up question on, is, but surely carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, and mightn't it cause dangerous warming? Now, as I said earlier, that was a very good question to ask in the late 1980s.
Sure.
Because carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. And what does that mean? It means that if you've got molecules of carbon dioxide and water vapor, which is a much more important greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, in the atmosphere, then as the Earth's heat radiation tries to escape to space, so some of it is intercepted and bounced back, basically, by these greenhouse gas molecules, and it causes warming in the atmosphere. That is not anybody's opinion. That is an established physical laboratory fact that those gases have that capability of intercepting radiation and re-emitting it. Okay, so if we've actually increased the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere by 30%, gee whiz, that sounds like a big number, then surely we must be going to produce dangerous warming. Well, the question was asked in the late 1980s, and since then, we've spent more than $100 billion, say that figure again, $100 billion have been spent by scientists trying to measure or identify that extra warming that we all know is there, must be caused by human carbon dioxide emissions. The fact that we haven't been able to identify the warming caused by human emissions doesn't mean that carbon dioxide isn't a greenhouse gas, nor does it mean that there isn't a human signal. What it does mean is that the human signal is so small that it's lost in the noise of natural climate variation, which is, of course, where you started the whole program off by asking that question more broadly.
Indeed.
However, that's sort of surprising, isn't it? How can you have a 30% increase in this gas, and yet the amount of warming, which theoretically we all know must be there, is actually unmeasurable? And the answer is this. Most people think that when you increase the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the temperature will go up in proportion to the increase. In other words, a linear increase. And it just isn't like that. The relationship between increasing carbon dioxide and increasing temperature is what a mathematician or scientist calls logarithmic. And what that means in everyday terms is less bang for every buck. Less temperature increase for every additional molecule of carbon dioxide. So it's a curve, and the curve goes off parallel to the axis at infinity. And what that means is that you can double carbon dioxide from the 280 parts per million pre-industrial revolution level, double that to 560, which is a number the green groups often go on about.
Yes.
And the amount of warming that will be produced, extra warming, is a bit less than a degree, not allowing for feedbacks, because there's all sorts of complicated feedbacks. And that's not in doubt. But we've already had more than half of that incremental warming must already be in the system, because we've been increasing these greenhouse gases for 150 years. So there's at most 2 to 3 tenths of a degree of warming to go to get to that doubling. And that's just not measurable or detectable against the other much greater natural variations in the system.
Now, of course, according to the IPCC and the mainstream science, the so-called consensus, there is a feedback effect which actually increases that again, which is due to water vapor. Now, this has been criticized by David Evans, and there's a great little video that I've put on Truth News where David Evans from Western Australia goes through his reasons for discounting that. What's your position on this water vapor concept, Professor Carter?
That's absolutely right, and you're absolutely right to recommend David Evans' writing and video to people. He's a first-class communicator and scientist. Yes, no, that's true, and that's why I said that if you double carbon dioxide, both the scientists working for the IPCC and independent scientists like David Evans agree that the amount of warming you'll produce first up is a bit less than a degree, about a degree in round figures. But if you then allow for the feedback loops, and the feedback loop you've just talked about is water vapor. So the argument goes like this. If we increase carbon dioxide a bit, because it's a greenhouse gas, that'll cause a little bit of extra warming. That little bit of extra warming will cause a little bit of extra evaporation of water from the oceans. That will give us more water vapor in the atmosphere, which is a more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. So there'll be additional positive feedback, water vapor warming, on top of the carbon dioxide warming. That's all completely logical. However, when we actually try to detect this increased water vapor in the atmosphere, you find that it's not easy to identify that. And the problem with just taking that feedback loop, which happens to be positive, is that it ignores lots of other feedback loops. And the other important feedback loop, which is not included in the United Nations models, is this. A little bit more greenhouse gas, a little bit extra warming, more water vapor into the atmosphere. Water vapor in the atmosphere causes low cloud formation. Low clouds bounce the sun's radiation back into space. That is a cooling mechanism. So that's a negative feedback, which is completely ignored. I shouldn't say completely ignored, but largely ignored by the computer models. So you see the problem, and those are only two feedback effects. In nature, there are hundreds of different feedback effects involving different parts of the biota, the trees and the animals and so on, and various physical mechanisms. So the problem with the simplification that goes into the models is it is drastically oversimplifying the real world and at the same time makes arbitrary assumptions about which feedback loops are the most important.
And actually, this leads me to just ask you briefly about the concept of the null hypothesis, which you mentioned to me in an email, which, as my understanding of it, is that there has to be in scientific research some basic position that you start off with to basically then counter it. For example, if you said, well, smoking cigarettes has no effect on health, smoking cigarettes is fine, that would be the null hypothesis. Then you bring in some evidence to say, well, actually, smoking causes these things and it can lead to emphysema, okay, cancer, etc.
Okay, let me interrupt you. Yeah, it's true that idea you had about smoking is a hypothesis. It's not necessarily the null hypothesis.
Right.
Let me explain. We tested at the start of this whole interview a hypothesis, the hypothesis that human carbon dioxide emissions will cause dangerous global warming. And that was a hypothesis. We tested it and it failed.
Right.
Because that's what scientists do. They test hypotheses. So the first thing you have to do if you're a scientist is, with respect to whatever you're investigating, you set up a hypothesis. The null hypothesis is the one that is the simplest in the face of all the facts.
Right.
The simplest hypothesis in the face of all the facts of climate change is that we look out the window, we see weather changing every day, and over long periods of time, the climate might get a bit warmer or a bit cooler, and this is all happening naturally. So the null hypothesis in a situation like that is that the changes we observe in the weather and the climate are natural until and unless shown to be otherwise. So you set up an Aunt Sally. And the null Aunt Sally is the simplest interpretation of the facts. It won't necessarily be the right one, because as you test that null hypothesis, if you find it's inconsistent with some fact or other, then you modify the hypothesis.
Right.
And it's still a new hypothesis, but it's a new null hypothesis, because it's still the simplest hypothesis that agrees with all the facts. Now, the cleverest thing from a propaganda point of view and public relations point of view that the IPCC and the supporters of dangerous climate change have done, the cleverest thing they've done is to invert the null hypothesis. And their view of the climate system is that any changes we see are caused by human carbon dioxide emissions until you, Bob Carter, can show otherwise. That is a complete prostitution of scientific method.
Yes, it's a bit like, guilty until proven innocent.
That's exactly right.
And you could sort of say, well, it's a similar principle. You know, if we're going to put someone on trial, we take the position that they're innocent, and then you basically introduce the evidence to show otherwise.
That's a very good analogy. That's exactly what it's like.
Yeah, and of course, you know, to and of course, in the question of climate, you know, this has huge implications for policy, doesn't it? For what governments are going to do. If the null hypothesis is not disproven, well, we don't really need to be taking any radical actions. You know,
absolutely. And let me pick up some of the ideas that are in newspapers every day. There's fewer polar bears. In fact, there isn't. There's more. But we're told there's fewer polar bears.
Yeah.
We're told there's going to be more droughts. We're told there's going to be more floods. We're told there's going to be more cyclones. All this stuff. All of those changes are consistent with the idea that the changes we see are within natural variation of the climate system. They are entirely circumstantial evidence. None of them requires human carbon dioxide emissions to be the causative agent. But the IPCC starts off by assuming that the carbon dioxide emissions are the causative agent. So they've got their science exactly back to front.
Absolutely. We are running towards the end of the hour, Professor Carter, but you know, in a future show, I would really like to continue on to look at some of the more socio-political questions, the questions of, you know, why is the media so biased, and also some of the stuff that you've documented in your articles about the way the debate or the, I guess, the way the conferences have been structured in such a way to prevent people like you speaking, I just think is a really important subject, really important to highlight for people, because a lot of people I speak to who agree with this, the essential government, you know, position, because they think taxing pollution is a good thing, right? They don't understand how people like you have actually been silenced. They're not even aware of it, because the silencing has been so effective that they're not aware, for example, that you've been invited to speak at conferences and then turned up and then been told you can't speak. I mean, this actually is really happening. And I just want to point out for our audience that there's a book, Climate, the Counter Consensus, which you can find on Amazon. Just put that into Google, Climate, the Counter Consensus by Professor Bob Carter. And we do hope to have you on the show again.
Well, Harry, it would be my pleasure. One last word from me, which is, you said that most of us sort of like to support the government reducing pollution. Of course we do, including you and me, but carbon dioxide is not a pollutant. Carbon dioxide is the elixir of life.
And we're going to have to end it there. I'm terribly sorry. Okay. We have run out of time.
That's
been
fine.
Awesome talking to you today. I hope to speak to you again.
Anytime, Harrywood. Cheers, bye.
Thanks. If you would like to support Truth News Australia, here's something you can do right now. Go to our Facebook page, and you can find that by going to the website and then clicking on the Facebook link. If you're not already a fan of our Facebook page, click on the like button. Then invite all your friends to become fans, and you can do that by clicking on the link on the right-hand side that says Invite Friends.